And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to you. And I'd like to speak for a moment directly to our listeners. If you're not already subscribed to the Hank Unplugged podcast, subscribe right now. That will ensure that you never miss a single podcast. Every review matters. My goal for Hank Unplugged is to bring, as I say over and over again, the most interesting, the most informative, the most inspirational people on the planet directly to you. And if you've been listening to the Hank Unplugged podcasts, you know I'm making good on that promise. This is a podcast that will help you grow in your faith, a podcast that will equip you to be a reproducing disciple maker. So if you're a listener of Hank Unplugged, you will benefit from essential Christian conversations. But here's your action step. Here's where you can make a difference. Leave a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you consume your favorite podcast. And that will help expand our audience and further equip a greater number of people to become reproducing disciple makers for God's glory and for the extension of His kingdom. Again, not by might nor by power, but by His Spirit. We have so many 5-star reviews. I've got lists as long as my arm. Here's one. I have an MA in apologetics, 2 MAs in Old Testament theology. I have thoroughly enjoyed Hank's broadcast. I'm often able to learn more in one episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast than in a whole month of my studies. That's just one of many of the 5-star ratings that we've received in the last few days. And again, you can make a difference. You can make sure that people all over the planet hear Hank Unplugged. I was just in Greece. People were coming up to me in Greece, in Crete, and in Athens, telling me about the Hank Unplugged podcast, the impact it's made in their lives. I was just a few days ago in California. Many, many people. I listen to Hank Unplugged. Well, again, it's not because of me. It's because I'm bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to you. And today is no exception. Today, I have the opportunity to interview someone who knows a whole lot about cultural apologetics. Her name is Megan Allman. She's a speaker with Life Training Institute. She addresses audiences, trains students on pro-life apologetics. And she's the author of an article in the Christian Research Journal, Seeing Red, The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. This is an incredible article. If you haven't seen this article, you can find it on the web at equip.org. With all of that, by way of introduction, Megan Allman, I am delighted to have you on Hank Unplugged.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's an honor to be on Hank Unplugged. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, The Handmaid's Tale is no longer considered by cultural elites to be dystopian. It is now largely rendered prescient, a prophecy currently realized on the stage of history in a government that separates mothers from children, in a government that is imbibing the horror of ICE, in a government that is installing travel bans alleged to keep millions of peace-loving Muslims out of the United States, in a government that is state-sponsored effort to silence truth-loving journalists, in a government that is precipitating newsroom slaughters carried out by right-wing activists, and in an all-out war against female reproductive rights a democracy that is in chaos due to the implementation of biblical rather than progressive values. In other words, what's going on right now is we are in the epicenter of a storm, and in that epicenter of the storm is the abortion debate. I was just listening to a TV show. It was the 4th of July special for Michelle Wolf, and she leads off with this salute to abortion. And the salute was, God bless abortions. God bless America. And when she said, God bless abortions, God bless America, on the 4th of July, people went crazy. She said, women don't forget, you have the power to give life, and men are trying to control that. Don't let them. Well, here's the thing, Mick. We have to now combat this kind of, well, it's propaganda. And the propaganda is being bought into quite uncritically. When you watch the audience, they are cheering her on. She is making sophomoric arguments, but she's winning with a platform. And I once heard a quote, and it's often attributed to Napoleon and various icons of the past. I don't know who this really comes from, but I think it's apropos. It is, if I can control your media and your music, I care not who makes your laws. And today, the media is pushing this abortion debate, and Christians have to be always ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within them with gentleness and with respect. When you first heard the implications of abortion being spelled out by Scott Klusendorf, you made a transition in your life.
Yes. I was actually working as a journalist prior to this. I was a reporter for a community newspaper in a pretty sizable town in Georgia where I'm from, and covered a crisis pregnancy center's fundraising banquet. Typically, the pregnancy centers will have them once a year. Most of them raise their money for the year that way. And because it was a community event, they sent me to cover the event, and Scott was the speaker at the banquet. And I remember being absolutely floored by the presentation that he gave. And it wasn't just that the presentation was on pro-life apologetics. I myself would have called myself pro-life. I'd never been equipped with the tools to talk about it the way that he was approaching it. But the entire idea that you could speak about something related to your Christian convictions in such a compelling and winsome way to a secular world, it was the apologetics that drew me in. And I went home and told my husband, something has to change. This has affected me so. And my husband, the great man that he is, made the decision that we should send me back to school so that I could tell these types of stories instead. And so the rest of the story, it took a couple of years to unwind, but the short story is, and Scott says it this way, I bugged him till he hired me. I wouldn't put it that way, but that's what he says, so we'll go with that.
You know, Michelle Wolf is calling the slogan a propaganda slogan. When you say that you're part of the pro-life movement, what she's suggesting is that you have made a propaganda statement, and that through that, you are twisting the minds of people to think that there's something wrong with abortion.
Yes. Well, it's the rhetoric. And as you were talking about a minute ago, the words that are out there, there's so many common terms that people care about, this set of values. We care about equality. We care about equal opportunities for men and women, sexual freedom. Freedom is a term that's thrown around a lot. But what those terms really mean or where they come from are where we differ. And that's what's often overlooked, what's behind the rhetoric. And when it comes to the abortion issue, there are a lot of assumptions being made about who counts in the human family, who counts among us, what is a person with value, and who gets to define who that is and what that is. And that's really where we camp out when we're doing pro-life apologetics, in order to make that clear so that we can then move forward.
Well, let's talk about that. What would make abortion okay?
Well, any other justification that you can give for taking innocent human life, that would make abortion okay, which I don't think there is one. Because really what we're talking about at the center of the abortion issue is, what is this entity that we're talking about? the entire debate hinges on the question, what is the unborn? What is this thing we're talking about? We can throw around justifications all day long and we hear them. And I'm well aware in this line of work that the justifications that are out there deal with important matters. Privacy, for example, is not is something that we take lightly. Poverty is not something that we take lightly. Abortion should enables women to pursue their careers or their education or their dreams without an unplanned pregnancy standing in the way. Or it prevents unwanted children from coming into the world or disabled children who may suffer. These are all important and hard-hitting things. As my colleague Jay Watt said, there's a lot wrong with abortion, but there's only one reason abortion is wrong, because all of those justifications are assuming at the outset that the unborn is not a human being like you and me.
Although there's a shift in the debate, it seems to me, the shift, Megan, seems to be from whether or not this is a human being to whether that human being is a person. In other words, whether that human being has true personhood that counts. So now, because of the technologies that are available, sonograms and so forth, you can see this is a human being. There's no question whatsoever that this is a human being. So now you have to say, yes, it's a human being. I have to admit it's a human being, but what makes that human being count is whether we say that human being has developed to a stage where we can call it a person.
That's right. That's a different type of debate. We've gone from a debate over science to a philosophical debate. You know, it's a philosophical question that asks, what is it that makes human beings valuable, or what is the thing that would determine that we no longer have a mere human being, we have a valuable person here? And there are really only a couple of ways to answer that type of a question. One of the ways that society answers it, and I would say predominantly our society answers it this way, is that a human being can be made into a valuable person based on an instrumental reason or a functional reason. This is the value system that I wrote about in the article that is depicted in the Gilead, this imaginary world that Margaret Atwood wrote about, but also the one that we ourselves live in, where human beings are attributed value based on their abilities or their traits. On college campuses, it could be anything from their ability to contribute to society to some kind of cognitive ability. All of these things are functional and vary from individual to individual. And the pro-life argument is that if we ground our value there, if we say that one of those reasons is the thing that would give us rights, first of all, we have to answer the question, the grounding question, as what philosophers call it, why is it that trait and not something else? Why is that the value-giving trait? And then secondly, we have to explain to what degree that trait has to be present, because traits and abilities come in varying degrees. And if we're going to ground our value on something like cognitive function, then we're going to end up with a society that says some human beings matter far more than others, because we have a sliding scale when it comes to that. So the only answer that ends up making sense philosophically is that we are beings of intrinsic worth. There is a basic human dignity that underlines or underscores everything else. It's the one thing we all have in common from the point we come into existence to the point of death. And, you know, long after that, I believe Christianity is true.
You know, Francis Schaeffer once said that this would be the watershed issue of our day. Do you agree that it is?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. In fact, I'm working with my husband right now at a Summit Ministries student conference. And when we do the pro-life presentations, my boss, Scott Klusendorf, and I share that responsibility at Summit. They generally put us on the first day of the conference because they understand that if students can make the connection that when we answer the questions, what does it mean to be human and valuable, the way that that affects, you know, they answer those when it comes to abortion is going to impact the way they answer those questions for every other injustice that we're looking at.
When I hear you speak, I hear Scott speak, I think, you know, if everybody could articulate this message as clearly as you do, we would put an end to the abortion mythology, the mythologies that are being propagated by people like Michelle Wolf. I mean, she's making arguments. They're very sophomoric. They're really, quite frankly, stupid arguments. And yet the audience is applauding. And when I see that, I think how critical it is that the Christian in the pew, those who take the sacred name of Christ upon their lips, are able, are equipped to communicate answers in this regard with clarity.
Yes. Well, as you said a few minutes ago when you made that quote, you know, if I can control your media and your music, if the storytellers drive the culture, we can look at that biblically when we look at the book of Daniel. You know, when Daniel was taken to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, brilliant military leader that he was, put those young men through basically a Babylonian Harvard, and the first thing he taught them was the language and the literature, because he knew if he could teach them those things, he would make them Babylonian. The stories drive the culture, and I think that if we can understand not only the truths that underlie this issue, but the fact that when we grasp these truths and walk in them, when we understand our inherent dignity endowed by God and walk in it, we have the ability to tell others far better stories about themselves than Michelle Wolf might be telling at the moment or than the culture is telling them.
One of the areas that you are passionate about, because you wrote the article that I alluded to earlier, Seeing Red, The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. What inspired you to write that article? Why is this so critical for people to grasp from the standpoint of cultural apologetics? And let me back up a little bit. I was just in Crete about 10 days ago at a conference. And one of the things I learned at that conference is about some of the ways in which kids are being brainwashed, in the sense that they're watching and using media outlets that are changing their worldviews. And so often we know nothing about it. For example, I heard about a game called Minecraft, 144 million subscribers. And when you think about those subscribers, they're in not the millennial generation, but Generation Z. And when you ask them about Facebook, they will look at you and say, that's for old people. They're involved with these kinds of video games, interactive mediums that are changing their worldviews. And oftentimes we don't know anything about it. So we're talking to them and we're speaking one language. They're speaking a completely different language. So it's like we're passing ships in the night. And I think it's critical for us to engage cultural apologetics. And that's what you did in the journal article, again, titled Seeing Red. I think it's critical that we know what the culture is feeding people, because so often they're more impacted by cultural norms than they are by Christian norms learned in Sunday schools, which are becoming increasingly irrelevant.
Yes, when I think about the games like that, particularly I've been with 3 weeks here with students of that particular generation, and one of the things that we address with them a lot is, because we're a worldview-driven conference that's going on here, they're hearing a lot about the different worldviews and how those worldviews inform, particularly our anthropology or the way we view what it means to be human. I think that one of the driving worldviews right now, or actually anthropologies right now, is a view of humanity. Nancy Piercy actually just addressed this in her book that came out in January, Love Thy Body. She was a student of Francis Schaeffer's and is brilliant in her own right. But this idea of this kind of rebirth of Gnosticism, as it were, a kind of a body-self dualism, and what that means is that there's the separation between the body, like the physical body, and what would be termed the true self. So what this does is devalues the body, kind of puts it in this place of saying, well, my body is nothing more than a machine that I use to satisfy the desires that I have, I being my feelings-based center or my psyche. You hear students say, it just has to feel right. And that really informs some of the decisions they're making. So with something like Minecraft, I think it feeds that view of, well, I can do with my body what I want as long as it brings me pleasure, and I can kind of write reality in the way that I want to. After all, these are all tools for me to use that satisfies the true self, and especially in a society that is driven towards individualism and autonomy, and it escapes the fact that we live always in relationship to our Creator. There are limits to our freedom. It's a dangerous type of thing, but that's run rampant. You see it with abortion. You see it in the denial of, if I can separate sex from its natural biological result. You see it in some of the other issues that we're facing that are kind of outside my purview as far as speaking goes, but homosexuality and transgenderism, just this idea that my body is not as important as the rest of me, whereas Christianity has been contrary to that all along and says you can't do to and with your body whatever you want because your body is essentially part of who you are. And whenever you begin to do these things, it's harmful to you, which is consequently what the studies have been showing with the rise of anxiety and other dangerous thoughts that are out there. It's crazy.
You know, in The Handmaid's Tale, the regime is reacting to this worldwide drop in fertility rates. If you haven't seen the series, it's pretty graphic. And the state-mandated biblical vernacular is invoked over and over again, epithets like blessed be the fruit. You know, of course, blessed be the fruit of thy womb, but they truncate it. Blessed be the fruit, or may the Lord open, as in may the Lord open the womb, the idea that God opens and closes the womb. These are posited in the series as skin-crawling epithets, and it's prescient of a police state in which we will soon live if America is under the repression of conservative courts. So there's this hysteria out there that we're going to have conservative courts, and because we have conservative courts, we're going to go back to back alley abortions, and we're going to have men controlling women. And it seems silly when you talk about it, but the audience is buying into it because the medium is carefully crafted to communicate this message.
Yes, and one thing that really bothers me about all of that, is the Margaret Atwood, when she wrote this book back in 1985, the premise of the story, or one of the many premises that she's running with, is if women lose what they term their reproductive freedom, that is their right to abortion, again, the rhetoric, then they're going to lose all of the other progress that they've made since suffrage, basically. And there's a real issue with that, as if all of these other goods kind of stand on that one, like an upside-down pyramid. If this one thing goes, then everything will fall. But what's wrong with that, even looking at abortion being this great good that women have, is this is not a society that is respectful of women. And it simply takes a perspective shift to see that this is a society that almost views being female as a disability in some sense. When a female's natural ability, biologically speaking, is to be able to carry a child, a great privilege that we have by right of how we're made or by design. And when society looks at that and says, no, that's a problem. We need to control that. That's not a society that views women as good or even equal. That's the society that views them as dangerous in some way or in the way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's something wrong when you now re-envision women. And you've written about this in your article. You envision women in stilettos, raking in six-figure income. That becomes sort of the idealistic woman. That is the thing we should always strive for as females. But this seems to be a false image of what constitutes womanhood. So I think women are being sold a bill of goods here.
Right. And I don't think that you would think this way, Hank. There's nothing wrong with someone who is in stilettos raking in six figures. But you're right that is somehow the idea of a woman's worth is equated to her ability to earn her wages, which was a large kind of message with the second wave feminism, as I understand it, as it rolled in. That women somehow needed to be able to do everything that men can do. I think I really appreciate Dorothy Sayers as one of my heroes, and she did not write a great deal about feminism, but she wrote a couple of essays that I really appreciated. And in one of those essays, you know, she kind of looks at it and says, to say that a woman is as good as a man is completely useless saying, unless we're going to understand at doing what. at doing what. So she would view being female or male as you know, adjectives to the thing that we are first and foremost, and that is human. So the way that comes out in the article is when I talk about that secular feminism, when it attempted to kind of free women or liberate women from men, it missed the very important distinction between attributed value, which is that functional type of value I was talking about, and that intrinsic human dignity. That first and foremost, we're human, and women are gifted in so many different ways. So to say that it has to look a certain way is very limiting and not at all what it means to be female.
Yeah, I like that. In other words, there's nothing wrong with the image in and of itself. What's wrong is that it is a limiting factor. It is a microscopic piece of the whole, and that is being forwarded as though it is the whole.
Right.
And in The Handmaid's Tale, you know, it's pretty interesting. The boogeyman is the environmental toxins. That's why the birth rate has plummeted in the narrative that you're watching. In the real world, we might rather take a look at what we're talking about right now: abortion, euthanasia, same-sex sexuality, gender fluidity, and the like. That's the real boogeyman.
Right. Well, as you're pointing to, the view that this is the highest good for women has kind of dropped this idea into the well, that women need to hurry up and get established in their careers. They need to push harder and harder and harder to climb that career ladder and really set themselves up well before they can think about having a family, being married and having children, if that's a desire that they have. And the result of that, because school takes a long time. Some of these careers that women are certainly capable of doing take many, many years of study. And to say that you have to put off childbearing for such a long time has had some pretty devastating effects, even within our own society. I did quote some statistics in the article. Just between 1970 and just a few couple years ago, 2015, the average age that a woman had her first baby went up from 21 to 30 almost. And it keeps moving farther beyond. Women are waiting longer and longer to have babies. Some of them wind up waiting until after their ability to bear children is kind of dwindling. So we have kind of a rising infertility in our own country for that reason. In fact, our birth rate right now, and as of 2015, it was at 1.8 per family. We need at least 2.1 children per family, just speaking strictly numbers, to keep our culture alive, to keep going. And we've dropped below that. I think this is a huge contributing factor.
It's huge.
There are consequences to that.
Yeah, there are huge consequences. I mean, you think one of the consequences, you're talking about a demographic time bomb. In Western cultures, as you're alluding to, native populations are dying out, and filling the vacuum are millions and millions of polygamous Muslims that have no intent whatsoever of assimilating into Western culture. In fact, they can't, because in Islam, Sharia is state and state is Sharia. So there are huge, huge implications. But something else you said caught my attention, and that is the fact that today the greatest value for females is deemed to be moneyhood rather than motherhood. Women who choose to remain at home are therefore overtly being designated as leeches on society, and that, I think, is a travesty.
Yeah, that was said by some more radical feminists based on those views back then. But that just goes back to what we were saying. You know, women are gifted and able in so many different areas, and that's the problem when we place attributed dignity on top. To say you're valuable for this reason. Well, number one, why that reason and not another reason? And number two, who says? When there's something better, something that grounds all of us, that is, you know, I always say the pro-life movement is all inclusive. It says every human being counts because they were given a dignity in virtue simply of being human.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's telling that Margaret Atwood, very much like Margaret Sanger, by the way, had a steely devotion towards abortion. Her concern was state-sanctioned surrogacy, a brutal form of female subjugation. But the real surrogacy is women being coerced into being surrogates for same-sex couples or for artificial reproductive technologies in general, I think.
Right. Ideas always have consequences, and so do technologies, even unintended ones. So when we look at reproductive technologies that are kind of on the forefront right now, we have to understand that, like anything else, a technology is a tool. It's the way that we use it that can be very, very good or not good. And the struggle of infertility is a real one that is felt within the churches, in part because of these ideas and in other part because we live in a very broken world. And that doesn't need to be overlooked. I think that needs to be considered strongly. But within that, we have to look at the boundaries. What should we be able to do with these technologies? And surrogacy is one that causes it gets messy. It gets very messy very quickly because we're dealing with human beings. And anytime we start to go down the road of making or creating a life for the express purpose of adopting out that life, I mean, the first big door we're walking into is that children look more like commodities than they do gifts. That's an issue. Children are not products. But also, it does, as you say, kind of exploit women, especially those who are desperate for money and are looking at this for a way to make money, the use of their bodies. Again, back to the anthropology I was pointing out a little while ago, this idea that the body is just a tool. It's not as important as the rest of me, and what I do with it doesn't really affect me unless I want it to. But that's not the way reality works. And so we're playing dangerous games, and human beings are suffering because of it.
I love what you just said. I mean, I don't love it because of its implications. I love it because of its correctness. But children are being viewed as commodities. And when children are being viewed as commodities, they become increasingly viewed as disposable. I mean, that's a logical extension of what happens when you commodify children.
Yes. I don't think this is always intended by people. But I do think that somewhat in the reproductive technology, just the word reproduce, it's very industrial instead of procreate, which is what used to be said. But when we begin going down this road, it's almost as if you know, you're listening to people talk about shopping for an appliance with these particular features, which, of course, is the danger of some of the tools that we're using, that we're, as C.S. Lewis said, we're going to conquer our own nature, but then who will have won? But the flip side of that coin is if we can produce them and they are things and we can choose how they are and we have this power over them, then certainly we can dispose of them if we see fit. And that's where abortion on demand rolls in. And what we're seeing is with the capabilities we have, particularly of detecting problems in the womb, if the child has some kind of genetic abnormality or is diseased in some way, that they're disposable. In fact, I was doing some reading recently with different cases that talked about parents who choose not to have prenatal screenings or parents who have the prenatal screenings and find out that their child has an issue and then refuse abortion. Those parents are often labeled irresponsible.
That's incredible. You know, I was thinking as you're talking about something that we had already touched on, but I think needs to be underscored. We're talking about the fact that Western culture is facing this demographic problem. More and more women are putting off marriage and childbearing. The biological clocks are running out. And there's a resultant problem. I talked about the problem being felt in the vacuum. The demographic problem creates a vacuum. Something has to fill that vacuum. And right now, it's polygamous Muslims, which Islam is now the fastest growing religion. It's no longer Christianity. Christianity is still the largest religion. But Islam is by far the fastest growing religion in the world today. And it's not a religion in the Western sanitized sense. It's a legal, social, political matrix that runs on the rails of Sharia. But that's not the only consequence. You think about the specter of wombs for rent. You think about what you alluded to, artificial womb technology, children being viewed as commodities. So we're facing some incredible issues as a result of the repositioning or the reimagining of women in a sense that is not coherent with a biblical worldview, but rather with this narrative that's been foisted on us by our culture.
Right. In this sense, perhaps, all the talk of the Handmaid's Tale being prophetic, in this sense, it is playing itself out. Because we have a society by virtue of these things, not the twisted take on Christianity that they abuse in the show and I think in the book as well, where they're taking scripture out of context completely and making it into something hideous. But in this sense, because of the ideas that have been dropped in the well of what it means to be human, what it means to be valuable, what femininity ought to look like according to cultural standards, we have created a value system or a spectrum on which we have, you know, the women at the high end of the value spectrum, kind of akin to the wives in the show. We have the econo-wives, or the working-class women. We have the women at the lower end of the spectrum who fill these needs that don't go away. You know, we still have homes that need to be run, and we still have children who need to be raised. So we have, you know, women who fill those roles while other women vacate them for whatever reason, perhaps for unhealthy reasons, which is what we're looking at here. And we have surrogates. We have our own handmaids, and those are the women, these wombs for rent, as you said, especially the women who are exploited into serving as surrogates because they desperately need the money.
You think about what is at the root of all these issues that we're talking about, and it seems to me, and I wonder if you agree, that it is the sexual revolution. I mean, it's sex without consequences. It is the idolization of sexual freedom. This is a motivating force for the mad rush towards all kinds of ills within our culture. And at the top of the heap is the abortion problem.
Absolutely. You know, when sex becomes the highest good that there is, there's no wrong with it. And anything that tries to challenge it is knocked to the side. That is a dangerous thing. Because what do we say about areas where sex is abused or abusive? It's going to be harder and harder to talk about why those things are wrong if sex is the ultimate good, or this sexual freedom, this freedom to express myself. Again, we could go deeper because ultimately it's a worldview issue. And it goes all the way back, you know, as far as Adam and Eve, if we wanted to start at the very beginning, when sin entered the world and broke all these relationships. But we can look at people, big heavy hitters, you know, at the Enlightenment, where David Hume's philosophy or empiricism kind of separated the idea of what we can really know and made the hard sciences the king of all knowledge, and things like religion and morality subjected to the realm of the unknowable. You just kind of make that up as you go, and that had devastating effects. And then we zoom forward onto Charles Darwin, who kind of with his evolution and Darwinian evolution, which said that it's just physical. It's all just physical. Well, if human beings are nothing more than cosmic accidents, which is essentially what that worldview points out, then of course there's going to be the assumption we can do what we want without consequences. And then I think the anthropology that I've been kind of alluding to, that body-self dualism, is driving a lot of what happened with the sexual revolution. If we devalue the physical and elevate experience and elevate feelings and decide that as autonomous individuals, what I do to and with my body is fine as long as it satisfies the true self, we get to this place where everyone is trying to do that. And with the rule of the day being, oh, we have to be really nice and respectful and kind, but without really a grounding for those things, without a transcendent source for the good that would dictate what is kind and respectable. We're in a mess.
We are in a mess. How does this predilection for defining men and women out of existence, how does that militate against the unique rights and characteristics of females? I mean, if you think about the mastery of men over women, that's where it really is. I mean, you have people in comedy shows foisting this narrative that, you know, men are simply trying to control women by trying to control their bodies with respect to the abortion issue and so forth. But the real mastery of men over women seems to be in the cultural narrative, where women are actually being, well, defined out of existence. When you say there is no distinction between a man and a woman, you're really militating against female rights, against the value of females in our culture.
Yes. I'm curious to see how this will come to a head, really, as we're moving forward, because this is where those ideas are going to clash. When we begin saying that I am what I want to be, what I define for myself, regardless of my biology, regardless of reality, that I can kind of write it for myself, But then all these, you know, all these years, it's been that has been the defining factor of, well, I'm female, and you know what feminism has done and where it's taken us has gone in a particular direction. I do think we're going to see some clash, and I'm curious to see, and a little trepidatious to see what will happen. I think I do what I do because I deeply care about people, and so I'm worried there's going to be some hurt along the way, a whole lot of it, and I pray not. I pray that there can be understanding and truth before then. That's why I do what I do with students. But we'll see.
Yeah, but if that really happens, I mean, it has to be as a result of people like you and many, many others who are communicating clearly a proper biblical worldview as opposed to the caricature of a biblical worldview. And that leads me to something that you alluded to earlier, and that is the criticality of becoming biblically literate in an age in which biblical themes and passages are grotesquely twisted to make Christianity seem dystopian.
Yes. It's surprising to me, even in, I work in a lot of Christian schools, that's where we do most of our speaking, in Protestant and Catholic high schools around the country. And it is surprising to me how often I am simply presenting a clearer view of even the gospel accounts of who Jesus is because of the picture that's formed from the cultural script. And when students begin to kind of catch a glimpse of him, there's an immediate intrigue about it. I mean, after I truly believe it is the greatest story ever told, and we're all a part of it. So that's an exciting notion. To begin to understand, you know, what is the story, and that it's all related. All these, you know, these books of the Bible across thousands of years, there's this unifying thread, and that unifying thread is Jesus, of course. But to see that and then understand that we're a part of that, I truly believe we have a better story to tell people.
I love that. We have a better story to tell people. In other words, there's a narrative that is being communicated by the culture. If we don't communicate the biblical story properly, we're going to be outshouted, overshadowed. With gentleness and with respect, we have to be able to communicate the biblical narrative. And that means that we have to become biblically literate.
Yes. Yes. And then from there, the ways in which we can do that in our day-to-day and in the relationships that we have are nearly limitless because people are incredible and their unique giftings and talents, when they discover what those are and begin to put them into use, stories are being told so many different ways, not just with words, but with, you know, with actions and in communities and through the arts, I think, which is vitally important.
I want to touch on something, and you alluded to this as well. You said that you're speaking in Catholic schools, Christian schools, all kinds of different schools. When you said that, I thought about the doctrine of unity. I call it the doctrine of unity because at the Christian Research Institute, we have a motto, in essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, and all things charity. And I think it's critical for us to recognize in the epoch in which we live that if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately, as Benjamin Franklin put it. And I think there's all too much fragmentation within the Christian world. There's an unnecessary disunity. In fact, a lot of people do not think we can even stand together on common cause issues. I remember when Chuck Colson was involved in a movement called Catholics and Evangelicals Together. I mean, he was virtually being lynched because for some reason or other, people thought that you couldn't work together on common cause issues. But I think it's critical that we do work together on common cause issues, that we recognize that we are to be unified around the essentials of the Christian faith. We can debate non-essentials, but this idea of fragmentation is an idea that ultimately leads to us being a whole lot less powerful in the world than we could be. We can be a leavening force, but a whole lot greater force for leaven in the culture if there's a unification around the essentials of the Christian faith.
Yes. I'm just, as you're talking, I was thinking about some of the things that I run through with the students. And one thing I find very, very helpful is that to understand that it's this fragmentation, a lot of it exists because of ideas that have been dropped into the well of the culture. I was mentioning the fact-value split a few minutes ago, results of the Enlightenment in large part. where we've kind of relegated religion to this upper realm that we can't really know it, and it's just so there's a view out there that says that morality and religion are subjective in nature. In other words, we create our morality and our faith. It belongs to us. I am the subject. I create that. And certainly in the debates over abortion in my field, that's probably one of the biggest hurdles that we face, particularly with students, is this idea that I can't tell other people what is right and wrong for them. When in reality, Christianity is objectively true. That's the only reason you should believe in anything. In other words, it exists, its truth exists apart from me and apart from you. And the things that make it so are not mine to define. But what I think we get caught up in, because of the influence of these ideas and, again, the lack of biblical literacy that's out there, when we're there, we begin to think, well, I'm being personally attacked. When you attack my view, this is a person. This is mine. When in reality, if somebody comes to me and they says, I think abortion is fine, it should be, in a sense, as if they've walked up to me and said, well, I think that 2 + 2 = 5. That's an objective type of thing. I don't know the alternative to 2 + 2 = 4, so I'm going to be very curious as to why somebody would think differently than that. But that kind of frees me up to go, they're not attacking me personally. Let's look at the ideas, but have the utmost respect for one another. That is traditional tolerance and what it looked like.
What ultimately provides all human beings with equality? I think that's an issue that needs to be driven home over and over again. The idea of intrinsic dignity in virtue of being created in the imago Dei, in the image and likeness of God.
That is exactly what provides all human beings with their dignity. When God made human beings, this is page 1 of your Bible, in Genesis 1:27, God created human beings in his own image, the image of God. He created them, male and female, he created them. That dignity is the imago Dei that's being communicated right there, but that is a status that is given to us or endowed to us by God. Now, when we were made automatically in relationship with him, and he endowed us with that. It wasn't something we made on our own or earned on our own. It is something we have by virtue of being the pinnacle of his creation, human beings. Nobody can strip it from us. We can't give it away, even though we try often. And that is very different from this attributed dignity that the world understands, that I have to be a certain way, I have to earn a certain thing. It's by virtue of what we are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not what we do.
Yeah, that's right. The Bible is in the cultural narrative, and this is a cultural canard. It's considered to be patriarchal, but that's based on description rather than prescription. If you look in the Old Testament, there are all kinds of people who are exemplars in many ways, but they're painted with all their warts and moles and wrinkles. And so they're described in a very realistic way, but that description is not prescriptive of what we are to do with our own lives. In other words, we're not to embrace the moles and the warts and the wrinkles. And I think this is one of the points that has to be made, because the Bible is not patriarchal at all. In fact, I would argue that the Bible makes a woman the greatest exemplar of all. So if you look at the biblical narrative, the first woman was deceived. The second woman, Mary, conceived and bore Jesus Christ. So if you think of the person that you most want to emulate, it would be Mary in her humility, in the fact that she is the person that, of all the people in the history of the universe, brings Christ to us, and Christ becomes the ladder of divine ascent, whereby we can be partakers, as Peter put it, of the divine nature. So our exemplar, from a biblical standpoint, the apex, at least, of exemplars, is a woman.
Yeah. I think about Mary often, of course, every Christmas when it comes around, but more often than that, just the type of humility that she embodied. And I think that oftentimes when we think about humility and meekness, we see those in Western culture as weak terms, when in reality, throughout the Bible, that is how strength is portrayed. Strength in the biblical account, yes, there are instances of people demonstrating great might, such as Samson with his great strength that God gave him, and David defeating Goliath. Of course, those are there. But those are also figures who, when they were obedient to God, when they were waiting on him and submissive to him, that is when their strength was at its greatest. So I do see, I think maybe caught up in somewhere in the cultural script is the idea that women have to be strong by performing in these ways or by doing these great mighty acts. That's not biblically informed all the time. Certainly there are women who are capable of great physical strength, but there's a different kind of strength that Mary displayed. And the other women that the Bible brings to light for us, you know, women like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth, certainly imperfect, even considered outcasts by the standard of the day. But God elevated these women. God did it and grafted them into where they are in the bloodline of Christ. I love telling my daughter the stories of these women. And of course, any biblical story, the true hero is God. But how wonderful to see the way that they trusted him.
Absolutely. And I think the biblical narrative with respect to women is fantastic. You think about Jesus Christ. He was a cultural warrior. He comes into a culture in which women are on the lowest level of the socioeconomic ladder. They're considered chattel. And then Jesus brings women into his inner circle, and they're considered ontologically equal with men. Or you think of the Apostle Paul saying that in Christ there's no male or female, there's no slave or free, there's no Jew, there's no Greek. If you are in Christ, you are the royal seed of Abraham and an heir according to the promise. Women are completely considered biblically to be on the same level as men from an ontological standpoint. And you alluded to this earlier, Megan. Women have unique roles. Men cannot fulfill those unique roles like women can. We all have unique roles, and we need to see our intrinsic worth as being human beings created in the image of God.
Yes, and the sooner we see that, the better able we will be to celebrate the differences as things that are real and to be appreciated instead of held in hostility. Jesus's treatment of women was so counter to what we see in The Handmaid's Tale with the commanders. Of course, again, the Christian scriptures being taken out of context and this being this representation of Christianity that's so falsely portrayed in this fiction. But those who are less familiar see it and go, oh, that's what it's about. I want nothing to do with that. I would much rather that they give it a closer look and see that Jesus is nothing like that in his treatment of women. In a society where they were considered second-class citizens, he never treated them as such, not once. And I could talk about him all day. So.
And we should. But contrast is the mother of clarity, as my good friend Oz Guinness likes to say. And you think about Muhammad by contrast. Muhammad is spoken in Western circles today by cultural elites with a reverential tone. And yet, his treatment of women contrasted with Christ's treatment of women ought to make any woman shy away from the very notion of Islam as some kind of a standard. It is counterintuitive. It is absolutely mind-blowing, I suppose, that you have so many women speaking about Muhammad as an ideal and sort of denigrating Christ in our culture today.
Right. I think you're absolutely right about contrast being that way, but also this shows how powerful, you know, the cultural megaphone can be. I think in conversation it often helps to ask good questions to bring that to light. Questions being, of course, I think that one of the best ways to go about these conversations, because they are so inviting, they're not threatening, they are winsome, and can be very gentle, but they get to the point, and Jesus was the master of asking great questions.
We often think about that as the Socratic method, but you're bringing it back to its origin.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I want to get back, actually, to The Handmaid's Tale for a moment, but before I do, you're also the author of an article in the current edition of the Christian Research Journal, What's in a Name? A Growing Trend to Abolish the Labels Pro-Choice and Pro-Life. Planned Parenthood claims that the labels pro-life and pro-choice don't accurately portray how most people feel about abortion. But the reality is that this claim pretends that there's a moral neutrality with respect to abortion, but as you point out, that's a myth.
Right. Because the issue really does hinge on the moral status of the unborn. What is the unborn? Is it a human being that is intrinsically valuable just like you and I are, which addresses both the science and the philosophy? Is it that or is it not? So people who claim to be moral are actually taking a position because either we should protect children from abortion or we should allow abortion to continue because it's no different than clipping a fingernail or pulling a tooth. And to say that I'm not going to take a position is to take a position when it comes to that.
Absolutely. Again, that is an article in the current edition of the Christian Research Journal. And these articles we put up on the web at equip.org. So eventually you'll be able to find the article on the web at equip.org. The Handmaid's Tale, I want to get back to that for a moment because I glossed over that very, very quickly. You're an expert on that series. Talk about the background and the plot so that people know what we're talking about. If this is the first time they heard of The Handmaid's Tale. Of course, if it is, you've probably been living under a rock because this is a cultural phenomenon.
It's everywhere. If you're seeing pictures of red nun habits of people protesting reproductive rights or abortion rights, then that's where it's coming from. Now, Margaret Atwood is a Canadian author and a feminist. She's an advocate of abortion, but she's written several books along these lines. She's very interested, I think, in displaying where cultures can take really bad ideas and put them into play, and bad things happen to people, this being one of them. So she's created this fictional world that she calls Gilead, again, taking these biblical kind of terms and references, you'll hear several of them, in which a group of very fundamentalist and violent so-called Christians, who call themselves the Sons of Jacob, have violently overthrown the government and taken over. And they've created this whole patriarchal society of what is left of modern America. At this point, I think they're kind of shrunk to more or less New England. And in that society, women have lost all of the privileges that they currently exercise. So women do not read, they do not hold jobs, they're not allowed to handle money. They are more or less fit into a functional kind of caste system that's created there. There are the wives of the commanders, who are the men who kind of hold power in the society. The econo-wives would be kind of the working class. There are Marthas, who take care of household domestic duties. And then the handmaids are at the bottom rung of society, and they are kind of enslaved but also revered because they are the only fertile women who are left. And these handmaids serve the family by serving as forced surrogates. It is a society that enforces a state-sanctioned rape, as it were, so that these handmaids bear the children for the families in the society but never get to be mothers themselves. In fact, they are turned into property. Their names reflect that. Our main character's name is Offred, which is literally of Fred, Fred Waterford being her commander.
Wow. When you describe this show, Megan, I have this confliction. And I'm sure a lot of people do in the Christian world. Maybe I should put it this way. You don't need to get into the gutter to know it smells. So the confliction is that on the one hand, you think maybe I should steer Christians away from these kinds of shows. On the other hand, if they become cultural phenomenons and you don't know about that cultural phenomenon, it's kind of like what I was talking about when I was talking about Minecraft. If you don't know about that, you can't speak the language of the person that's being indoctrinated by it. So it's sort of important with respect to cultural apologetics to know about these things so that you can counter these things. What's your view on that? Should we watch shows like this? Should we steer away? How should we process this?
Well, I had to struggle through that when I took the job and said, I will go ahead, I would like to research this and see what's going on. Because for me, I had friends who were talking about it, and I wanted to be able to address it with them because I knew it was alluding to something that wasn't quite right. And boy, did I find out. So I actually began by reading the book, and then I went and then I watched the show, the choice being because I knew I was going to research it for the purposes of writing this article and responding to it. I think I am careful in how I recommend the show. I definitely put a warning label on it as to what someone will see or choose not to see, as it were. It can definitely fast forward through certain things or block them out given modern technology. But it is very dark and disturbing, and it's meant to be. the show does not withhold the reality that's taking place with these rape scenes. It's very difficult to even think about or talk about, much less watch play out in a drama. So in that sense, be warned. In the other sense, this has taken the world by storm. And there are young women who are cheering Offred on. And when you follow the story, you can't help but do that. You want her to hang on to her identity in all of this, in this terrible world that she lives in, which is kind of the glimmering of hope that's there. You can't tell a good story, even entertaining one, without Christian worldview values somewhere woven through them. So my view on that is sparingly. I think it takes some reason and discernment. And for me, because I choose to work with young people and want to know what it is that they're taking in, I have to watch this show with a particular prayerful stance going into it, knowing I'm watching this to think about it, and it's going to be hard. And it was.
I think the principle here for me is that you have to be so familiar with the truth that when a counterfeit looms on the horizon, you know it instantaneously. And I sort of learned that principle as president of the Christian Research Institute in studying cults. There's no end to the number of cults that you can study. And some of the greatest cults today are actually philosophical naturalism and narcissism and scientism and so forth. These are the cults that are making the biggest impact on the minds of people today. It's not just Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and so forth. But the point is, Satan packages and repackages the lie in so many different ways that it's hard to keep up with it, even if you do it as a vocation. So I've always told people, Megan, that you need to be so familiar with the truth. It has to be part of your DNA. And then you'll spot the counterfeit. And then when the counterfeit is communicated to you in a cultural narrative, in a movie, in a series, whatever, you're going to have an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within you, and you're going to be able to communicate it with gentleness and with respect.
I agree 100%, and I'm grateful for the teachers who have taught me not just the Scripture, which is my first and best teacher in the Holy Spirit, but the teachers who have responded to the things before I've gone to them to be able to walk there and consider and find and root out the bad ideas from the good ones.
You're mentioning that this is no longer fiction based on what Margaret Atwood is saying. She's saying in interviews and so forth that this is not fiction. She thought she was writing about dystopian society, but this is actually the society in which we live today. That's the narrative that has been foisted upon us. This is what is happening today, and therefore, if we don't have a revolution in our time, our democracy is done.
Yes, it's happening today, and it's not happening for the reasons that this show would claim, or that that more secular society who is championing the show is thinking. It's happening from the ideas that we wrote about in the article and others.
How are the root causes different between Gilead and the America we live in today?
Well, the root causes of this version of what's happening, this functional society, are some of the very things we've been talking about. I think it's a combination of factors. I mentioned three in the article. One was secular feminism, this idea that a woman's worth is something that is functional. Abortion on demand, which flows kind of out of this idea that because of function being the highest good here, that we wait and establish careers and have commodified children to some respect and now have this abortion on demand, the ability to separate sex from pregnancy, which is abused. And then, of course, the functional system as just period. Anytime that we begin to say human beings matter because of something that differs among human beings, we create unjust societies.
It is so critical for all of us to be ready to give an answer. And I think that you do that with great clarity. And we're very, very grateful for the role that you're playing. And I think what you're saying, and perhaps you can elaborate on this, is that you can't do the job alone. This is not the job that is to be done by the hired gun. Every single believer needs to be involved in the process. And if every believer is involved in the process, we can have a solution to the cultural chaos in which we live. You look at the cultural chaos, and it oftentimes is just, it's tantamount to throwing up your arms and saying, there's no chance whatsoever. The culture has won. We've lost the cultural wars. And so, in some eschatological paradigms, just wait until you get raptured and let the world go to hell in a handbasket. But really, we can win the culture wars. You think about the fact that in Roman society, first century society, girls were considered to be worthless. And those girls were left wailing before the statue of Nero, waiting to expire. This was a horrible society, and yet Christians turned that society upside down. And the reason I want to end with this is I don't think we should throw up our arms. We shouldn't have a defeatist attitude. It's a sinking ship, and therefore give up. We can change the culture, but it really means that we grasp a hold of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Christ rose. Because he rose, we have hope. Because he rose, we know we can stand against the culture, even to the point of shedding our own blood, because we know that there is another life. And so we can make this life count without being politically correct, without being popular, without looking to prosperity. We can make a difference. We can turn the world right side up, but it takes believers being counted in the process. And I suppose that's a message you want to communicate.
Absolutely. My favorite part of my job when I'm talking about the abortion issue with students, aside from addressing the injustice and bringing awareness to it, because that's vitally important, is that I get to tell them a story about who they are and why they matter, a true story. And I get to back it up with philosophy and then point to the scriptures. And to the degree that people are willing to believe and understand who God has made them to be, that when we place our trust in him, he adopts us and empowers us with the same Holy Spirit that raised him from the dead, that we have the ability to walk in a world and not be defined by it at all. So I think we live in fear of what others might think or what the cultural climate is like, or that we're not the professional, or that it's too hard, or that someone else will do a better job. I know I face those fears every day, but to the degree I understand that he is working through me, I can kind of look at the world and do as Paul did, who certainly embodied this so well, when he faced the most powerful people in the known world of his day. And he says, you can do what you want with me, but you cannot have me. That's a dangerous way to be in a world like this one, in the best possible sense for Christ, because the world does not know what to do with people like that. And it is attractive, and it is wonderful, and it gives you the footing to be able to pour into the lives of others, because you're kind of free from being in bondage to yourself when you give that sin to Christ who died for it.
And you're a spokesperson, not only in the culture, but you're a spokesperson in the home. Talk about that for just a moment, people listening in. You're a mother, and so you have a responsibility as a mother to raising your children in such a way that they become change agents. And that's as important, perhaps more important in terms of priority, you put that as number one.
Absolutely. I have a daughter who's 12 and a son who is 6. And they are their own little personalities. They are tiny people, or they've been tiny people. They're growing people now. And it is a privilege and also a great responsibility, very humbling, to watch them grow into the people that God has made them to be, and to try and understand their gifts and their talents, and to encourage those in the right direction for the kingdom. We started when they were very, very young, teaching them just the phrase, why are you valuable? And their response was always, I'm a human being made in the image of God. That was first and foremost. They didn't understand that at the time, but that's what we want them to understand as they grow and kind of grow into that truth and that knowledge and to walk in it. My husband, who is absolutely wonderful, I mentioned him earlier, but I can't brag on him enough. He certainly sees the work that I do as our family's ministry, and he just says, you're just the face of the ministry, Megan. And so when I go on the road to talk to students, it is a wonderful and comforting and empowering thing to know that at home, my children and my husband are praying for these opportunities. They're praying for the students. They're praying for me. And they have turned it into saying, we get to send mommy out to do this. So I pray that as they get older and they see opportunities where they can certainly usher in the kingdom in their own way, in their own gifts and strengths, that they will walk in that and not listen to the script.
I'm so glad that you have chosen this as both a vocation and an avocation. It's critical. You think about countries like Iceland, very, very proud of the fact that they're eliminating all Down syndrome babies. And in that kind of a milieu, you're saying, look, if you're created in the image of God, if you are given intrinsic worth as a direct result of your relationship to the one who spoke and the universe leapt into existence, then you have value whether you have a disability or you don't have a disability. This is a critical time in which we have to point to intrinsic worth. You think about the evolutionary paradigm that you alluded to earlier. The evolutionary paradigm is telling you that if you have defects, you have to be eliminated. And that is because if the unfit survive indefinitely, they're going to infect the fit with their unfit genes, and then evolution doesn't work. So at the bedrock of a theology or a philosophy that's permeated our culture is the rooting out of people that we don't think have intrinsic worth. In that kind of a milieu, it is critical that there are people that know what they believe and why they believe it. And I love the fact that what you do is training. It's a life training institute. It's not saying I'm the hired gun, I can solve the problems, but you're saying I can train you and you can do this just as well as I can do it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and to get to tell students, these are identity issues. And as you're talking about, there are some who would identify themselves by saying, well, I'm not good enough. I'm not. And some who even identify themselves by their sexuality, because that's what the sexual revolution has taught them. When I say we get to tell them a better story about themselves, that's exactly what I mean. Because to some degree, what Christianity tells us is we are all faulty. We are all broken. But there is one who was not. And when we understand what he has come and done and rescued us from, then we can walk in wholeness, towards wholeness. It's remarkable.
It's liberating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's liberating. Oh, well, Megan, I really appreciate what you do, and I appreciated this conversation. It was a lot of fun talking to someone that really knows what they're talking about. And again, we're talking about a watershed issue of our time. There's nothing more important than the foundation of life. I mean, that's where it all starts. I mean, Adam and Eve were given a commission to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and take dominion. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and we're to love our neighbor as ourselves. To love our neighbor truly is to tell them the truth. So we have to be bearers of truth, and I think you're doing a tremendous job of that, and I'm grateful to you not only for being involved in the Hank Unplugged podcast, but writing for our journal and the work you're doing with the Life Training Institute. And I think it's wonderful that your husband and your children are praying for you. Prayer is the slender nerve that moves the arm of omnipotence. And to see that your children are there praying for you along with your husband, that's got to be gratifying.
It is. There are very few words, but it is a privilege to serve the kingdom alongside of you, Hank.
Well, Megan, I loved having you on the podcast, and I will pray that God continues to use you for his glory, for the extension of his kingdom, that it gives you strength and health along the way, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much.
God bless you. And for all of you listening in, the Hank Unplugged podcast is reaching quite literally around the world. And it's a result of people that take the action step. The action step is going to iTunes and giving us a 5-star rating, but also sharing the podcast with others. Word of mouth has extended the reach of this podcast. I started doing this podcast, I think, a little more than a year ago, and I have been absolutely amazed at the impact it's had. Quite frankly, when my son David came to me and told me, you got to start doing podcasts. I had no concept whatsoever of what a podcast was. I've been doing a broadcast for 30 years, but I didn't really understand what a podcast is. And now I hear of people all the time that take these podcasts and they're listening to them as they're driving to and from work. They're listening to them in all kinds of different venues and forums. And these podcasts are equipping people. And that's really what we're looking for. People that are equipped, always ready to give an answer. Again, it's almost cliche-ish, but it's important. I hope it's impressed in everybody's mind. We are to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within us. And we are to do that with gentleness and with respect. And when we do, we can be agents of transformation. Now, the Christian faith is not transactional. It's transformational. We oftentimes think this is all about simply praying a prayer. Once you've prayed the prayer, now you get a card that keeps you out of hell, gets you into heaven, and for the rest, you live like baptized secular humanists. That's not the way it works. The Christian faith is a transformational faith. We are transformed from glory unto glory, from one realm and sphere to another. And part of that transformation means that we are becoming, by grace, what God is by nature, which means we are, as Peter said, partakers in the divine nature. Now, obviously, when Peter is saying that, he's not suggesting that we can become what God is in the Godhead. We cannot. But we can be brought into the fellowship of the Trinity. In fact, we were created for that very thing. And we have the responsibility not only of enjoying the riches that God has ordained for us, but bringing others into that enjoyment as well. And that's part of the core values that we bring through the Bible Answer Man broadcast, through the Hank Unplugged podcast, the Christian Research Journal, and our 24/7 outreaches around the world. Let me add, not to be commercial, but let me add that this is a ministry. Our ministries are supported by listeners like you. If you're benefiting from the podcast, you can support the ministry in a safe, secure fashion. You can do that on the web at equip.org. Again, equip, EQUIP.org. You can also write us at Mox 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can talk to Resource Consultants live when you go to the phone and dial 888-7000 and the letters CRI. Enjoy the podcast. Make sure other people enjoy the podcast by giving us a 5-star rating, and tune in next time for another Hank Unplugged. So long for now.